present some work on thermal conductivity measurements that the aim of which is to shed some light on what may be the symmetry or the topology of the superconducting gap energy or superconducting order parameter. So as condensed matter physicists, we rarely, in experiments anyway, we rarely work in isolation. So this is a collaborative effort between Cambridge, Stanford, and Waterloo. So the samples were procured. The dealer was Mike Sutherland, who's now a Royal Society Fellow at Cambridge University. And they came from Ian Fisher's group in Stanford via his postdoc James Analytis. The measurements were performed in Waterloo with the help of, this is the wrong thing, let's just get a pointer. Yeah, with the help of John Dunn and Issam, they were hard working on the dilution fridge to take the data. And then more recently, William Taves Tews has been working on some of the analysis of this data. Okay, so the iron lictides, we've had a bit of an introduction from Seamus. But it's rather remarkable that it was February 2008 that Hosono and co-workers first reported a 26 Kelvin superconducting material that contained iron. And of course, this goes against everything perhaps Bernd Matthias would have said about where to find superconducting materials. One of his rules would have been stay away from magnetism, which would have meant stay away from iron. We now know that magnetism is fairly sympathetic or even useful for superconductivity, and so that's perhaps not one of the rules to pay that much attention to at this point in time. So it's a layered material. We have the active part is an iron, either a nictide or chalcogenide layer, hence now people tend to refer to more iron-based superconductivity rather than iron nictide superconductivity. And separating those iron chalcogenide or nictide layers are other materials, and the families that exhibit superconductivity now encompass five different families, of which I've shown only two here. So we have the 1-2-2 family, such as strontium iron arsenide, here, where the layer in between the iron arsenide layer in this case is fairly simplistic, or you can get more complicated things in these 1-1-1 families, where now we mix two elements in that chart in that layer that separates the active layer of the iron nictide or chalcogenide layer. The ions are arranged in a flat sheet. And then the nictide or the chalcogenide iron sits staggered either side of that. And it's thought that actually the coordination of this this atom either side of the layer may play a fairly important role in determining the strength of the superconductivity. The phase diagram that results from doping these systems now seems to be generically determined, and Seamus pointed this out. Maybe a couple of things to add is that one can dope these systems with electrons or holes, and it's not clear that it's entirely doping that's driving this phase diagram. It's possible that structural issues may well be playing a role as well in terms of achieving this phase diagram. The Fermi surface of these materials seems to be on a fairly firm footing. The principal bands that cross the Fermi level are derived from iron d orbitals, and we end up with four principal sheets to the Fermi surface, two hole pockets at the gamma point in the center of the Brillouin zone, and two electron sheets centered at the end points at these pi-pi wave vectors. And the important aspect of this Fermi surface is the potential for nesting between these hole pockets and these electron pockets. If they happen to have very similar sizes, then one vector will nest entirely these two pockets. And one can see then that as one dopes the material and changes the relative size of the electron pocket and the hole pocket, this nesting potential for nesting will decrease. That suppresses the magnetism and then brings on superconductivity. So then in terms of superconductivity, the pairing is pretty well established as being singlet. That's from night shift measurements showing that there's no local magnetism, and so therefore the pairs must be in the singlet arrangement. And the likelihood of pairing through phonons is not great because of the very weak electron-phonon interaction, and that has caused people to concentrate principally on magnetic-mediated Cooper pairing. And therefore, the Fermi surface becomes a very important quantity in establishing that. And we can then let our imaginations wander and think, dream up some fairly interesting and novel order parameters and symmetries because we have the potential for nesting, or at least the magnetic order driving the pairing of the Cooper pairs. And so if the nesting happens to be between, say, the hole, get the right one, the hole band and the electron band, and the coupling is of the right sign, then we may have this S plus minus type order parameter, where we have a fully gapped order parameter on each of the hole and the electron sheet, and there is a change in relative phase of pi between the order parameters on each of these two sheets. That's the so-called S plus minus order parameter that was pushed very early on and still seems to be hanging around. But one can also then take that a little bit further, and depending on, so this would infer that there are nodes in the order parameter along this line, for example, but it doesn't cross the Fermi surface, so we don't see any nodal quasiparticles for that. If we allow the nodes to actually intersect some of the Fermi surfaces, then we can have a nodal S plus minus wave, where now we have a fully gapped whole band in the center of the zone and a nodal order parameter in this electron sheet. Now, this is still an S wave, still forms under the S wave symmetry, because if you rotate by 90 degrees, you get back the same thing. If you reverse the situation here and allow for the nodes on the center and the fully gapped order parameter on the side that changes sign as you go around, then we have now what we would call a D wave, where we get a change in the phase of the order parameter when we rotate through 90 degrees. So the object of our measurements is to try and figure out which of these potential candidates is indeed exists in iron nictide superconductors. And our primary technique for doing that is, such a big stage, it's great to just wander around, is thermal conductivity. And how does thermal conductivity allow us to answer or at least access information about the superconducting order parameter? Well, what it does is access information about the magnitude of the order parameter. In particular, we can establish where the order parameter may go to zero. And how do we do that? Well, we can't use, as Seamus was showing earlier, things that will directly allow us to see the quasiparticles. We have to do a little bit more detective work and use some theory. So when we measure thermal conductivity, we measure contribution from electrons and phonons. This is the total thermal conductivity. And we're going to try and separate. We're just interested in the electronic part, and we're going to separate it from the total conductivity using the temperature dependence of these two terms in the low temperature limit. And we motivate that on the basis of kinetic theory formulation, where we can write that the thermal conductivity is given by the specific heat times the velocity times the mean free path. So that means that for phonons in the low temperature limit, when the specific heat is cubic in temperature, the velocity is the sound velocity, and the mean free path of the phonons has grown sufficiently long that it reaches now the boundaries of our sample. These two terms, the velocity and the mean free path, are temperature independent, so the temperature dependence of our thermal conductivity of phonons in this limit will in fact be cubic. What about the electrons? Well, for the electrons, I find it easier to think not so much in terms of specific heat, but maybe more fundamentally in terms of the density of states. So if the superconductor is fully gapped, then the density of states will look like this, and this gap in the density of states gives rise to activated behavior at low temperature. And so if we're looking at the linear part of the thermal conductivity, of the electronic thermal conductivity, this will go to zero as the temperature goes to zero. Conversely, when we have a nodal superconductor, for example, a D-wave superconductor, then the density of states goes linearly to zero at zero energy, which means that in any real material, there's the possibility of pair breaking at arbitrarily low energies. And what this does is that, what this means is that impurities will alter this density of states picture to give us a density of states that is approximately constant and finite over some region of energy known as the impurity bandwidth and given the label gamma. Now, I guess a little bit confusing because in a moment I'm going to use gamma, which is normally used for the linear part of the specific heat, but I'll make sure that I make the distinction. So we have this impurity bandwidth. We have a roughly constant density of states at this low energy, and that means the specific heat will be linear in temperature, much as it is for a regular metal. And then the thermal conductivity, using that kinetic theory formulation, will have this linear temperature dependence. This gamma here is now the gamma from specific heat, not the impurity bandwidth. It's unfortunate that the two carry the same label when I want to put them on the same chart like that. So what this means ultimately, though, is that if we have a nodal order parameter where we have a finite density of states from impurities, then we will get a finite linear thermal conductivity as T goes to zero, and we'll take that as evidence for nodes. Okay, so that's going to allow us then to measure our thermal conductivity of our iron nictide superconductor down as low as we can to zero and extrapolate to see if we have a linear term in the thermal conductivity. If we have no linear term, we'll assume the system is fully gapped. If we have a linear term, then we have evidence for nodes. As an example of this, I show some work done on these filled scutery-like materials where within the same family we have a nodal superconductor, praseodymium, osmium, and timonide, and isostructural with that is a BCS superconductor, praseodymium, ruthenium, and timonide. So if we plot kappa over T as a function of T squared, we plot the data and we extrapolate down to zero temperature, we see that in the nodal case, we get a finite linear term, and in the BCS case, we get a very small value. Of course, this is real science, so it never goes truly to zero, but the point is to take this in the context of this value and see that clearly there's a very large difference. In fact, you can do much better if you don't model the phonons as T cubed, but allow this power to float a little bit, and then this really does come into zero. And that's just a reflection that the phonons are not being scattered necessarily. It's a question of specular or diffuse scattering of the phonons from the boundary of the sample. So this is the game we're going to play in iron nictide superconductors. Now, our choice of sample was to use something very simple at the beginning to get into this project, and so we picked this lanthanum iron phosphorus oxide, a member of the 111 family. It's one of the few stoichiometric iron-based superconductors. In fact, it may be the only
No, I guess
certainly one of the few stoichiometric, which means that it's very clean. It has a low TC of 7 Kelvin and a non-magnetic ground state. It's isostructural to the lanthanum iron arsenic oxide, which I showed earlier, where you can dope with fluorine to get this 26 Kelvin superconductor that launched the entire field. The Fermi surface is well established from de Haas van Alphen and ARPES studies, and here it is. We see this hole pocket and the electron pockets out at the zone corner there. The level of 2D can be gauged from the anisotropy and transport measurements. Now I'm not talking about the same anisotropy that Seamus was talking about. This is a C versus in-plane anisotropy, and it's about 15 to 20. So nowhere near as two-dimensional as the cuprates, but still a certain degree of two-dimensionality associated with this material. We have a single crystal sample. It has a very high residual resistivity ratio of 85 for such a complicated intermetallic material. The sample is tiny. It's 100 microns by 75 by 25 microns, so it's a fairly thin platelets. And to get the contacts on this was a real tour de force done by Mike in Cambridge. And we made the contacts by using evaporated gold pads. And that's part of what enabled us to actually be able to measure the thermal conductivity in such a small sample. Okay, so straight in to the results. And here we plot now the thermal conductivity as a function of T rather than T squared at a variety of different magnetic fields. Here's the zero field data coming down. This is 1 Kelvin down into zero. The lowest temperature points here are about 60 millikelvin. We apply a very small field, and we get a large jump in the conductivity, and then proceeds up to here, where they increase the field by a factor of 2, and there's almost no change. We take this to be in the normal state. And then as we increase the field further, we get some regular magnetoresistance, which brings the conductivity back down again. Now, in terms of examining this data, one thing I want to draw your attention to here is the fact that, according to the analysis that I just gave you, the phonon term should be fairly constant, assuming that phonons are insensitive to magnetic fields. But clearly, we have a large gradient here and then pretty flat and parallel gradients here. So how do we interpret that? Well, one possibility is that this is the true phonon conductivity here, and in the zero field, we have not only an intercept due to quasiparticles, but some temperature-dependent term as well. And that's going to be an important part of our analysis, so we want to try and take care of that. And so that's what I do in the next slide, is to take this 20 millitesla data, subtract off the linear term, and assume what's left is then phonons. Now, I don't do that in complete isolation. I want to look at the magnitude of the phonon term that I get. And so here it is. So we took the 20 millitesla data. We took off the intercept. We called that phonons. Here it is plotted. We can calculate what the value should be based on specific heat data. And the specific heat data gives us 1 T cubed, and the fit here gives us 1.2 T cubed. So indeed, this looks like a reasonable estimate of the phonon conductivity that we can then subtract off the total conductivity, the blue curve, to give us the electronic part, which will be linear term plus temperature dependence. And so that's what we were showing here. So the first statement, then, is clearly we have a sizable linear term in this material, which we interpret as nodes in the superconducting order parameter. The two order parameter symmetries that I showed you earlier that have nodes are the nodal S plus minus and the D-wave order parameter. And so we want to try and see if we can separate now between those two. How am I doing for time, Dave? 5 minutes left? Okay, so that's not too bad. So the D-wave part, so if we examine it in terms of a D-wave superconductor, then this very old, quasi, well, very old, it's now 15 years old, is a very important paper in terms of establishing what thermal conductivity you'll find in various types of unconventional superconductor. It shows that the electronic conductivity will have a linear term, and then the next order will rise as the square of the temperature. So we've plotted now that electronic conductivity is kappa over T versus T squared. So the first thing is the universal linear term here, which is universal in the sense that it doesn't depend on scattering rate. So we've written it here as though it does maybe depend on scattering rate, because we have a normal state scattering rate given by gamma here, but it's compensated for by the normal state conductivity. So actually, when you examine this whole product here, there is no dependence on scattering rate. If we calculate it using the specific heat data, then we get that the value should be about 2.9 milliwatts per Kelvin squared centimeters, and we measure 3.5. Well, this is just a fairly simplistic theory, and there's a certain error bar associated with that, so maybe this agreement isn't too bad. But I think more worrying is the fact that the electronic temperature dependence above the linear term is not particularly cubic. We can force it maybe by taking some tangent down here, and then we could calculate what this coefficient is, extract a gamma, this gamma is the impurity bandwidth, and see what it says about the scattering rate. If we do that, we end up with a scattering rate that, in comparison to what we know is the scattering rate from the normal state conductivity, the scattering rate is about two orders of magnitude too small. So really, not only is the temperature dependence not working very well, but in fact, the overall magnitude is not really consistent with the D-wave theory. And we can show that as well by looking at the normalized electronic conductivity, normalized by the normal state value, on a normalized temperature axis to compare with the figures in this paper. And you can see that all the temperature dependencies have superlinear temperature dependence, whereas ours is definitely would appear to be either linear and then maybe getting sublinear as we go higher in temperature. Okay, so what about the S plus minus situation? Well, as far as I can tell, there's no clear analytic expressions to compare to, so that makes the comparison a little bit qualitative. Here is, just to remind you, here's the nodal S plus minus type of symmetry that we're comparing to. And here is the thermal conductivity as calculated by Mishra in this paper here. And the first thing to note is that the linear term is now non-universal in this type of setup. So we get a linear term that depends on the scattering rate. Obviously, we can do more samples now to establish whether that is true. But also, the thing I like here is that the temperature dependence is sublinear in this plot, as with all the temperature dependencies of the thermal conductivity that one would get according to this type of order parameter. So certainly no smoking gun, but nonetheless, qualitatively, it's very consistent with the types of behavior that is being considered in this particular scenario. Okay. So just to get towards the end then, we can also talk about the field dependence, but it turns out in terms of separating between nodal S wave and D wave, this doesn't really tell us very much. Both of those types of symmetry give very similar field dependence to the thermal conductivity. We get a very rapid rise at low field, a plateau, and then an increase in the thermal conductivity as the fully gapped band, the quasiparticles there, get activated as it's suppressed by the magnetic field. So again, it's qualitatively consistent with the types of behaviors that one would see in this paper by Mishra. So finally, just to then convince us that we're doing everything correct, in the normal state we can compare with the Wiedemann-Franz law. The data is a little bit more noisy than I would like, partly due to the small size of the sample and the fact that we can't put very much electrical current in to measure the charge transport. But nonetheless, you can see that to within a few percent, we get good agreement between these two curves, one of which is the thermal conductivity, the red, and the second is the charge conductivity put into thermal units using the Sommerfeld value of the Lorentz number. Okay, so what about other experiments? Well, the penetration depth seems to show evidence for nodes in that there are power law temperature dependence of the penetration depth as one comes in to very low temperatures in comparison to the activated behavior one would expect based on a fully gapped Fermi surface. But these guys can't do any they can't do much more than establish the presence of nodes, certainly can't establish much more than S plus minus versus D wave. And then let's put it in the context of some other iron-based superconductors. There's a very nice summary chart in this review paper by Paglioni and Green that looks at the field dependence of the thermal conductivity for a variety of different systems, mostly of the 1-2-2 family. There are none of the 1-1-1 family. But what we can see is that in some instances, one has zero thermal conductivity in zero field, so no evidence for nodes. And here, one has a nodal or evidence for nodes by having a finite thermal conductivity. So it would seem that one would require an order parameter that, on the one hand, under certain circumstances, can give you a fully gapped Fermi surface, and on another instances can give you nodes. And that would also be consistent with the overall S plus minus umbrella, depending on the subtleties of the nesting vectors that give rise to the magnetic instability that you're using as a coupling mechanism. Okay, I see Dave's on his feet, so I need to just wrap up. So there are the conclusions. We have a finite residual electronic conduction in zero temperature. This is evidence for nodes in the superconducting gap. The value of that is quantitatively consistent with the universal D-wave expectation. However, the electronic conductivity overall doesn't have the appropriate T-cubed temperature dependence that we would expect in a D-wave scenario. On the S plus minus side, the data is qualitatively consistent. We need to work harder now with the numerics to see if we can make it quantitatively consistent. That's going to need a little bit more theoretical input than we have in the group at Waterloo, so we'll be farming that work out. And then in the broader picture of iron-based superconducting families, the sensitivity of gap topology to Fermi surface details, because of this magnetic coupling mechanism, makes the observation of both nodes and a fully gapped structure a possibility within the same S plus minus symmetry order parameter. And with that, I'll thank you and take any questions.
So I've got a quick question. So in your analysis with the T-cubed contribution to the electronic conductivity, did you use a Born or a unitary?
Oh, yeah, so that's in the unitary limit. Okay. So we see then the scattering rate is way too low. It suggests a mean-free path bigger than our sample. We can do the same in the Born limit. I haven't actually done that yet, but based on the value we're seeing there, I think it's likely that the scattering rate will be now too high and would then not be consistent with this 7 Kelvin TC.
Okay.
So given all the different examples of gap structures which are being reported from different techniques,
yep.
I mean, is it ever going to be possible to determine something about the mechanism from the gap symmetry in these materials?
Well, I think the quantitative, knowing the Fermi surface, and then applying some of these quantitative techniques for the thermal conductivity, I think there is the possibility of progress there. But in terms of knowing, so is about the coupling mechanism, really, is that where you want to go? I think what one really needs is some kind of phase-sensitive technique.
I suppose I should ask the question another way. Do you think there are different gapping mechanisms when you get different symmetries, or do you think there's a universal mechanism and various...
I'd like to think there's a universal coupling mechanism, but, I mean, that's just my opinion.
Okay, so I think we should thank Rob again and move on to the final speaker.